Good afternoon. My name is Jennifer Bissett, registration number 13150. I represent Charlotte Zolman. Ms. Zolman is unfortunately unable to be here today because she's sick. I do have a question. I filed the opening brief, respondents asked for an extension. Their extension created deadline problems for me because I was attending a course in Wyoming for a week. I filed a motion for extension of time, which was granted, but it was granted and I got the extension the same day. The extension was to the 21st. And the order was received in my office on the 21st when I was out of town. So I'm wondering if my reply has been accepted by the court.
It has been accepted by the court.
Okay, thank you. I read through my briefs in preparation for today. I believe that I've covered a lot of the pertinent issues. We believe that the overwhelming evidence in the Zolman case that was before the administrative law judge established that her care was transferred by referral from Dr. Primack to her primary care physician. I counted 11 times in his testimony at hearing on April 5th, 2010, that he made a transfer of care to her primary care physician to work up what he considered to be work-related and non-work-related conditions. Respondents have argued and said that, well, he only referred her for a limited purpose, but I don't believe the record supports that conclusion. I don't believe the record supports that conclusion by the judge as well. If Dr. Primack had referred Mrs. Zolman to her primary care physician for a limited purpose to assist him in working through the differential diagnosis for her condition and in order to arrive at a treatment plan, we would have seen a different coordination of care. Instead, Dr. Primack repeatedly testified that he was providing continuity of care by discharging her to her primary care physician to take care of all her conditions. So I believe under there are a number of cases where a physician becomes authorized on referral by an authorized treating physician. Those cases start with Greger versus Industrial Commission. So a Colorado Court of Appeals 1985 decision, Mason Jar versus the Industrial Claims Appeals Office, Court of Appeals decision 1993, Bestway Concrete versus the Industrial Claims Appeals Commission, also Court of Appeals decision 1999. I particularly like the Cabela decision that this court rendered in 2008, that if the ATP thinks the condition is not work-related, discharges them to the primary care physician, and that condition is found to be work-related, there's a referral, and that physician becomes authorized.
What was that last case, counsel?
It's Cabela versus Industrial Claims Appeals Office, 198 Pacific 3rd, 1277, 1281, Colo App, 2008.
Thank you.
Are any of these cases in your brief?
Yes, Your Honor.
Cabela involved a worker who, if I'm not mistaken, suffered a knee injury.
That's correct.
And that was her only injury that anybody was treating, either the ATP or the referred physician, right?
It appeared from the record to be limited to that.
Here, Dr. Primack testified that he was, I'll say he was concerned, I'm not sure what his exact words were, about claudication, peripheral vascular disease, problems in her legs, with her leg, that was causing the injury. And his testimony seems to say that he referred her to Dr. Yamamoto for consideration of these conditions. At least the AG found that Dr. Primack encourage claimant to see her primary care non-occupational physician for this issue, referring to the leg issue. So does that distinguish this case from Cabela, where there was only one injury? Here he may have referred her for a different, or he apparently did refer her for a different injury according to the ALJ.
Certainly the factual circumstances are different. The factual circumstances in every case are different. It's by analogy only.
If he referred her for a different problem, he didn't relinquish treatment of her with respect to her back, did he?
Well, I think he did, because he took the position it was no longer work-related. He doesn't say why he thinks it's no longer work-related.
What's no longer work-related? The knee, the leg
injury. The back.
I thought he said I couldn't treat her anymore because there was nothing more I could do for her.
Well, I don't think effect. I beg to differ, Your Honor. I don't believe the record supports that. He repeatedly testified throughout his direct examination that he didn't know what the underlying condition was, that you have to get to the underlying condition to know what you're treating, and he didn't get there. He didn't undertake responsibility for getting there. Formulating a diagnosis and a treatment plan, well, in particular, it's required by the treatment guidelines in the Division of Workers' Compensation. Physicians are required to follow it. They're required to come up with a diagnosis and a treatment plan. Dr. Primack didn't do either. He ordered a CAT scan, and on the basis of those results, he discharged her, said it's no longer work-related. But he doesn't really explain it, because the radiologist had recommended an MRI, the radiologist had recommended a DEXA scan. On cross-examination of Dr. Primack, when I was cornering him about, look, this CAT scan shows more findings. Other physicians have interpreted it as a worsening of conditions structurally and objectively. And he said, well, you just can't go on the report. And I know I prepared for this before I came here, that you can't rely just on reading the report to determine what her condition is. You have to do an exam, take a history, look at the studies, formulate a diagnosis and a treatment plan. He did not do that. When he referred her, when he discharged her to her primary care physician, she chose Dr. Yamamoto. He did those things. He did an exam. He came up with a diagnosis. He referred her for tests. He referred her to an anesthesiologist who was effective in treating her condition. So where it kind of comes down to, and here's what I don't understand about how the judge ruled like this, is Dr. Primack's saying she's got some vascular problem. She got a vascular problem. Injections aren't going to help her. But she got injections, and they helped her tremendously. She had 10 months worth of relief from pain. She was able to function better. She got a second injection, and that helped her as well.
According to her testimony, it helped her. But according to the doctors, there was a difference of opinion about whether that was a reasonable medical treatment for her condition. So what is the ALJ to do? Doesn't he have conflicting expert opinions here?
He does.
And he picked the ones that he thought were more persuasive.
This is what I'm suggesting, that these decisions should be based by an ALJ, not on his subjective opinion as to the credibility of the physicians, but actually on the objective findings from the diagnosis and treatment. We've provided overwhelming evidence of objective medical condition supporting that it continues to be work-related. That includes the studies that there's been several MRIs, several CAT scans, a history of x-rays. I believe that Dr. Reese did a really great job in a 130-page deposition of explaining what her condition is, what he looked at, and why it's still work-related. He's an authorized treating physician.
And that's the right. It's conflicting. Find out one or the other, and we can't overturn that unless we find there is no evidence to support his decision to, let's say, follow Dr. Primack's opinion. And Dr. Danny, I think, is the other one.
Well,
you're asking us to find as a matter of that there was no evidence to support his opinion, but there is evidence.
I'm saying there's not substantial evidence, because Dr. Primack did not complete the diagnostic workup. He admitted on cross-examination he had no diagnosis. He could really not challenge he couldn't challenge the radiologist. He couldn't challenge Dr. Reese. He couldn't challenge Dr. Schwepman. In fact, he didn't. You know, Dr. Primack flip-flopped all over the place. He agrees that the compression fracture caused a change in the mechanics of her low back, that can cause this kind of nerve compression and it can cause this kind of pain. And then there's a number of treatment options. But, you know, pinning him down was like, well, I have a bad analogy and I'm just not going to give it. I was thinking about a greased pig, you know, trying to get your arms around it and you can't hold on to him. My position is that when he transferred her care and said, I'm not going to treat you anymore as of June 2007, we notified the insurance company and they did not provide her with another physician to take over her care, that the right of selection transferred to the injured worker at that point, and she chose Dr. Yamamoto. The argument is, well, Dr. Yamamoto wasn't her treating physician prior to that. She can choose anyone. The right of selection is unfettered once it moves over to the injured worker. Our position is that Dr. Primack referred her to her primary care physician for treatment, that he discharged her from care. The primary care physician made appropriate referrals. He should be deemed authorized. His referrals should be deemed authorized. Those physicians should be paid for their care and treatment. And I'd like to reserve the remaining 4 minutes and 30 seconds that I have for rebuttal, unless you would like to ask
some more other questions. Documentary, is there any documentary evidence that he released her from his care, that Dr. Primack released her? Or is this just based on your interpretation of his deposition testimony?
Hold on.
Okay.
I believe that we submitted his reports would be Exhibit 13. There are two records on appeal. There's 10 CA and then there's 12 CA. This is under 10 CA. Would be our Exhibit 13 to the hearing. He,
In CD1, you know how that's working? You don't know, never mind.
2011, 2007.
Okay.
He says, there's no need for me to see Mrs. Ullman back in follow-up given the fact that she's no better, no worse, and she does have multi-level degenerative disc disease, which is independent of her work injury.
But that is a release of her to it.
Yes. Well, it's a discharge. Yeah, he says right in here too, right before that, I encouraged her to see her primary care non-occupational medicine physician for this issue. Because he thinks she has claudication, but Yamamoto didn't find that. And neither did Dr. Reese. And he testified he discharged her. I guess I now have 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Unless there's some more questions, which I'll answer. Okay, thanks.
Cool.
Hey, please, the court. I'm Harvey Flewelling, registration 22605, representing the respondents, Horizon Healthcare LLC and Pinnacle Insurance. With regard to the argument that Dr. Yamamoto was referred to by Dr. Primack, I think Judge Richman correctly stated that, or indicated that Cabela is distinguishable. Based on the fact that the treating physician in the authorized treating physician, the designated provider, had referred the claimant in that case to the personal physician for treatment of the knee injury based on the mistaken belief that the knee injury was not work-related or not compensable. And here we have a case where multiple authorized treating physicians treated the claimant's low back injury, and Dr. Primack identified this calcification of the iliac aorta and only referred the claimant to her personal physician for that condition, and that was recognized by the ALJ and the ICAO.
I thought, or I was under the impression that referred for all conditions with an opinion that kind of like, well, the one condition isn't work-related anymore.
Are you speaking of the Cabela case?
I'm talking about this case. In other words, you know, Dr. Primack saying kind of like, I can't do anything more with her, it's not work-related. Send her on to someone else. If you're sending her on for everything, doesn't that include one thing, the one thing that's at issue here?
If he was referring her for treatment for every condition she had,
mm-hmm.
I agree that if it was part of the, if everything, every condition was the work-related condition,
including the work-related condition, which he now says is no longer work-related, apparently.
Well, I disagree with that characterization of the record. I think, as found by the ALJ, and now there were clearly there was conflicting evidence, but the finding was with record support that Dr. Primack referred the claimant only for the leg symptoms that he related to calcification of the iliac aorta. He stated, as well as Dr. Danahy, he was also a treating physician, an authorized treating physician. They both stated after years of treatment, there was nothing further that could be done for the low back injury, which was the compensable injury. It wasn't like they were refusing to treat. It was, in their medical opinions, there was nothing further that could be done with regard to that.
Counsel just cited us, Exhibit 13, this memo from Dr. Primack. I take it your position is when he refers to this issue in the memo, he's talking about the leg issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
I think that's how the ALJ, but he also says, I can't treat her anymore. He says, there's no need to see her anymore. So is that releasing her? I think this is what Judge Day is asking. Is that releasing her to another physician for everything else?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that we're talking about an opinion saying at that point in time, the doctor said there was nothing further that could be done. That doesn't mean that he's refusing to treat for non-medical reasons, which is the legal standard that must be used here to determine whether the right of selection had passed to the claimant. I also want to remind the court that Dr. Danahy remained an authorized treating physician. He was the original designated provider. So at this point, whether Dr. Prime, even if Dr. Prime said, I'm done with this, I refuse to see this patient anymore, we still have an authorized treating physician on the case.
But that doesn't, there can be more than one authorized treating physician.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the case law says if an authorized treating physician, i.e. Primack, refers her to another for more work, that person can become the authorized treating physician. I'm kind of paraphrasing what I understand the case law to be. Isn't that true?
Yes, that's correct. If it's a referral for the work-related injury. And the condition that Dr. Primack referred the claimant to Dr. Yamamoto or to the claimant's personal physician is a condition which I don't believe the claimant has ever argued that it was related to the work injury. I think essentially the claimant has conceded that this leg calcification problem is not related to the compensable injury.
You would disagree with opposing counsel's argument that the record would not support the conclusion that claimant was referred only for a limited purpose to another doctor.
My position is that there's
conflicting evidence. Was that a yes or no? Okay. Go ahead, counsel. I'm sorry.
Our position is there was conflicting evidence. There's evidence that could, if the ALJ had credited certain evidence, he may have found that this was a referral for all conditions, including the work-related condition. But that's what the ALJ does is resolve those conflicts of the evidence, and the ALJ has the right, as Judge Richmond pointed out, to credit all, part, or none of the testimony to resolve the conflict.
Let me ask a question. The conflicts, do they arise from Dr. Primack's own testimony or Dr. Primack's own documents? In other words, was the contradiction within Dr. Primack's own evidence?
I think, no question, yes. There were conflicts within his reports. There were conflicts in his testimony.
So the conflicts were basically like, I refer
her for a limited purpose, I refer her for all.
I don't read the record as showing that he referred the claimant for all purposes.
So there's no evidence indicating that he referred her for all.
There may be evidence, I'm not sure, there may be evidence that would support a finding when, for instance, if Dr. Primack said in his testimony that he discharged the claimant to her personal physician, that may be interpreted as saying, I'm referring her for everything to another physician. But that's not the way the ALJ interpreted the whole of Dr. Primack's opinions, which are numerous reports and probably numerous hours of testimony. So the question is there substantial evidence in the record to support the finding that he only referred the claimant to a personal physician for this non-work-related condition? And we submit, yes, there is substantial evidence to support that. And the fact that the claimant cites evidence that was not found credible or persuasive by the ALJ gives no grounds to disturb the ALJ's order.
Do you
address the second issue, although Ms. Bissett didn't quite get to it. Whether the treatment by, I guess we'll call them, sterile, these injections, the epidural injection.
Yes, Your Honor.
Whether that was found to be, whether there was record support for the ALJ's conclusions that they were not reasonable and necessary treatment, which is really the guts of this anyway, I think.
I thought that was the case.
I thought so too, but okay.
But I don't believe in claimant's briefs that she really...
She does raise in her brief at the end, and she does suggest that there wasn't evidence to support the ALJ's conclusion. And you might just respond as best you can to what she said. I'm a little confused myself about what the position is. Maybe she'll clear it up for us.
Well, with regard to the epidural steroid injections, Dr. Primack and Dr. Danahy gave opinions that at least no further injections would be reasonable and necessary. And I believe Dr. Reese also testified, I could be off, it might have been Dr. Danahy, concerning the risks involved with the epidural steroid injection. So not only did Danahy and Primack testify that they didn't, that their opinions were that the injections were not reasonable and necessary and may be damaging, but those opinions would constitute substantial evidence to support the ALJ's finding.
But Dr. Schwettman either testified or somehow gave some evidence that he was the one who gave the injections, and he said they would be helpful. She testified that they were helpful. The ALJ could have credited her testimony that they were helpful, which I think is what Ms. Ullman's arguing about. It ought to have been credited. And Dr. Reese says they could have been helpful. I think he said he didn't think 6 a year was appropriate, so that was maybe too many. So you have conflicting evidence, and the ALJ has the right to pick and choose among the battle of experts. I take it as that's your opinion.
That's exactly my position, Your Honor. That we have, this is a very highly contested case, and there was a lot of conflicts in the evidence. But in the end, it's the ALJ who must, you know, has the power to credit the testimony that he wanted to based on the evidence. So our position is. Those opinions regarding the reasonableness and necessity of the injections support the ALJ's findings.
I read the report, or I have the report in front of me that Dr. Primack wrote in January of 2010 about the injections. He says a third epidural steroid injection could be done, so he doesn't say it couldn't be done. However, more likely than not, the yield would be low. I guess that's doctor's way of saying there might not be much benefit from it. But is that really an opinion that it's not reasonable and necessary? Or is he just saying that you could do it, but it's probably not going to have much effect?
I believe it's an opinion that it's not reasonable. It's within the ALJ's discretion to interpret that as an opinion that another injection would not be reasonable or necessary because it's not going to do any good. I believe Dr. Danahy's reports in 2007 and 2009 also support the ALJ's findings. I mean, they both basically, not only did they say the treatment, the injections specifically, they questioned the reasonable necessity of them. Maybe they didn't say, you know, absolutely not, don't do it, but they basically said another injection is not going to be helpful, or at least probably won't be helpful.
Marginal. Seems to be saying here. Is it enough to get a...
Well,
but she said she wanted it. As I read her testimonies, paraphrased by counsel, she really wanted these injections. She felt that they were very helpful to her.
Again, there was also evidence that there was a risk involved if she had osteoporosis, I believe. So those are just pieces of evidence that the ALJ can use. Also, the as we've already covered, the fact that Danahy and Primack essentially also testified that they didn't believe any further treatment for the work injury was needed. So not only did they in general say no further treatment was needed, they specifically pointed to the steroid injections as something that they did not believe would be very helpful.
And do you read the ALJ's opinion only as addressing the epidural steroid injections? It doesn't rule out other possible medical treatments. She can come back again and ask for other treatment to be paid for, right?
That's, I believe so, and that's what is in our brief. That
said that, okay.
The ALJ
had a reservation clause in his order saying anything not specifically determined is reserved for future determination. So I don't believe the order stands for the proposition that he's denying any further maintenance medical benefits. Matter of fact, respondents, Pinnacle has admitted for post-MMI medical care, and that's still, the case is still open with regard to that.
Just factually, she did have some of these injections, but I take it the insurer did not pay for those. She paid for them herself or some other way they got paid for or something. We don't know.
I know Medicare paid for some things. Oh. I don't believe Pinnacle paid for the injections, but okay. I just don't know.
So your position at Primac is still then the authorized treating physician?
Yes, Your Honor. He's one of the authorized treating physicians along with Danny. I'm not sure. I think Reese's, the referral to Reese was a limited referral, but certainly Danahy remains, he was the designated provider and remains an authorized treating physician. So, interesting conclusion, I think the claimant is basically requesting the court to reweigh the evidence and substitute its judgment for that of the ALJ, and which is not permitted under the applicable law. And for that reason, I request that you affirm the final order of the Industrial Claim Appeals Office. Thank you.
Just a couple of points of clarification. Pinnacle did not admit for post-MMI medical care when she was placed at maximum medical improvement. That's in the record. It's 12 CA 459. Pages 94 and 96, they specifically denied liability for medical care. We had to go through a hearing for over a year and a half to get an order for medical care. And then within 1 month of being awarded medical care, because the order is May 3rd, 2007, she was discharged by Dr. Primack. So the problem we have here is she's been awarded treatment. She's been awarded post-MMI care. She's been sent to a doctor who has discharged her, won't provide the care, hasn't finished the diagnostic workup. I honestly don't know what more I could do to help Mrs. Zolman prove her entitlement to additional medical care for pain control. Her symptoms have been the same. It's been back pain radiating into her leg. The diagnostic studies confirm that her injury got worse over time because she has mechanical instability in her back. It causes compression on the nerves. That's Dr. Primack didn't disagree with that. That was Dr. Reese's testimony. That was Dr. Schwetman's evaluation. She's got medication allergies. She's allergic to this lidoderm patch thing. She can't take that. So the thing that works, the thing that she's not allergic to, these epidurals, and they gave her relief. They gave her a lot of relief. We don't know that that's going to work indefinitely. We don't know that she's a surgical candidate, but she's entitled to the benefit of the order that gave her post-MMI medical care for pain relief, for pain management. Even Dr. Primack has testified that even though she has all these allergies, other things can be tried, but you still have to get to the underlying condition. He never did. The treating physicians, Dr. Yamamoto and Dr. Schwetman and Dr. Reese, got to the bottom of it. They fully understand her condition, and we're asking you to reverse the judge, that his order is not based on substantial evidence in the record, that it's not supported. And one final word about Dr. Danahy. Dr. Danahy saw Mrs. Zolman after she began care with Yamamoto and Schwetman. She had an epidural injection in August. She was seen a month later by Danahy. Her testimony is she got 10 months worth of pain relief from that epidural. So she was 1 month out when she saw Dr. Danahy, and he said, great, she's doing better. I think that confirms that the treatment worked. It doesn't confirm, however, that Dr. Danahy offered to provide her care.
Has she gone back to Danahy or Primack since 2010?
I beg your pardon?
Has she gone back to see them and asked for more treatment? Are they refusing treatment since this time?
You know, Pinnacle has made Dr. Primack their expert. Even the ALJ recognized him as Pinnacle's expert. They've sent her back to Primack, asked him to do evaluations, asked him to really come out with opinions in their favor that supports a denial of treatment. This isn't a fair playing field. I'm out of time, but I'm happy to answer any more questions.
Thank you, counsel. Argument.
Thanks, Judge.
This will stand submitted. Opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.
Thank you very much.